The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the Pod of Thunder and Rock and Roll. And we got some more rock and roll and blood spewing. Give him the axe style rock and roll. Continuing today with special guest Lizzie Borden. A new album coming out on Metal Blade Records. His first in over a decade. It's called My Midnight Things. And you're going to find out why he decided to record new music after 11 years. We're also going to talk about his love of horror movies and how that inspired his stage characters, costumes, and bloody theatrical shows. We talk about Alice Cooper, Kiss, The Tubes, all of his influences, the Hollywood metal scene in the 80s, hanging out at the Rainbow on the Sunset Strip, and how Lizzie Borden lost at least two guitar players to Ozzy Osbourne's solo band. Lizzie is also going to tell us about the time Gene Simmons almost produced an album for him, why it didn't work out. Also going to tell us all about Decline of the Western Civilization Part 2, in which Lizzie Borden was a huge part of that movie. And the new record, My Midnight Things. Great to have Lizzie Borden back on the scene. Very, very cool stuff. Great rock and roll with Lizzie and great rock and roll coming up with the Foz. I'm going to be playing some great heavy metal and rock and roll on Octane and New Fozzy this Friday night on Rock of Jericho. If you have suggestions for the playlist, hit me up on the Twitter at Talk is Jericho. And meanwhile, in the meantime and in between time, tune in to the show on Octane Sirius XM Channel 37 Friday night at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. That's when it debuts. We're going to have some new music from Bullet for My Valentine. New music from Grandson. No one's ever heard of them before. That's why I'm doing this on my show. Plus, we'll play some classic Ozzy and some Spinal Tap with a couple of quotes from Derek Smalls, who was on Talk is Jericho last week. What a great informational interview that was. We learned all about the Choctaw Indians and fitness bathtub routines, so go check that out. And check out The Rock of Jericho this Friday night at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on Sirius XM 37. And check out the Judas Rising Tour starting up again in July. We're going out to do Rock USA in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. The Cadot Rock Festival, though I'm Canadian, is it Cadot? Is it Cadot or Cadot? Tell us at Talk is Jericho. The Peoria Riverfront Fest in Peoria, Illinois, and the Belvedere, Illinois, at Apollo Theater. And then we're going over to Hungary at the Pheasant Festival July 26th. And then we're doing all throughout Europe, Prague, Germany, Switzerland, Italy, more Germany, all across the place. So please check that out. We're doing Bloodstock in Canton Park, in Walton on Trent, Derbyshire, August 12th, go to FozzyRock.com for all the information. And, of course, Judas Rising Tour beginning again August 24th in Atlanta, Georgia at Smith's old bar. Then we're going to Huntsville, Clarksville, Little Rock, all across the United States. Make sure to check out FozzyRock.com for all VIP information, all ticket information. We do a mini concert for all you people. It's going to be a great, great time. So go check that out, FozzyRock.com, and get ready to check out Lizzie Borden. He's returning after 11 years, one of my all-time favorites right here on Talk is Jericho, and it starts now. All right, so I was in Albuquerque, New Mexico the other day, and I was listening to some tunes on Shuffle, and Me Against the World came up by Lizzie Borden, who's here with me right now. And I just started thinking, like, man, like, these songs still hold up. That's such a great record, visualized. And I thought, I'll call Lizzie and see if he'll be available to do the show. And here we are talking to Lizzie Borden, which is very cool. We've met a few times, but never really had a chance to really sit down and talk. So,
yeah, I mean, I think every artist is kind of like known for one song.
Yeah.
You know, I guess, you know, Kiss will be Rock and Roll All Night.
Yeah.
Cooper's School's Out.
Yeah.
Me Against the World seems like that's my song.
That's the big one, right?
Unless I can come up with something else, which is what I'm working on.
So was that kind of the biggest quote-unquote hit for you?
Yeah, that was the one that kind of And it, oddly enough, the subject matter it turned out that way too, because he never really, you know, the way that I do things was never, I was never able to join any other clubs. Mm-hmm. You know, we played with Slayer and we played with Poison. Hmm. You know, it was such a mixed bag, and we were never part of anybody's. Hmm. You know, when the thrash movement started happening, everyone band together, they were able to play together. And then when the glam movement, all those, and we were, you know, I was the odd man out, you know.
That's interesting, because stylistically, Lizzie Borden, you know, you kind of had a little bit of a glam influence and like the shock rock thing that was going on at that time. But musically, there was Priest elements and there was Maiden elements, but there was also a lot of balladry involved. So it was very diverse.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking of the movement that was happening. I was thinking of my influences were, it was mostly the glitter rock of the 70s, you know, all that. It wasn't really the glam thing for me. It was more of the glitter rock, more of the show business aspect.
So what are you talking about, like Bowie and Slade and that sort of thing?
Yeah, Bowie, Sweet, and all those English bands. Mm-hmm. And then also the New York movement that was happening. New York had a huge thing with Kiss and New York Dolls.
The Dolls,
and,
right.
And a bunch of those type, you know, even in every, in, everybody was influenced by some of the stuff that was happening in New York as well, even the English bands.
But you grew up in L.A., right?
I grew up in L.A.
What was going on in L.A. along those lines? Was there anybody?
Here, this was the star maker place, because like Roddy Bingenheimer, he was like, you know, Bowie came here to be famous.
So Bingenheimer was the famous DJ out here.
He was able to put him on the radio in the U.S., and what he did, everyone else copied. Oh. So Bowie was big in the UK, but that's it. Mm-hmm. So he comes here, gets on the radio, he puts him on the radio and makes a star out of him. And that's kind of what happened. Everyone was coming here and filtering through, and then the rest of the US would catch on.
So growing up in LA, like in that 70s time frame, who were you into that was playing out here? Did you go see some bands live? And
well, the first band that I had ever seen in an arena was Kiss.
Okay.
And right. That was like, that changed everything. Mm-hmm. But I was, you know, I was into all those bands. I didn't see my first concert till I was 15.
Gotcha.
So, but you know, after that I was on the scene. I seen Quiet Riot when they started, you know, mm-hmm. Before they, you know, with Randy.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of those, you know, the Starwood stuff.
Lizzie's black cat is licking my face right now. And of course you have a black cat, which is awesome. What's his name?
I call him Chaos.
Okay, so Chaos is the special guest host today here. What about like with Van Halen around that time?
Yeah, I saw Van Halen a lot. Just all the bands that were playing, mainly the Starwood out here, which was a really great club. But the Whiskey and everything else.
Was the Starwood down in Hollywood too?
Yeah.
That was kind of in that Whiskey Rainbow, Gazzari's type
was,
area.
It was on Santa Monica, so okay. It was off the beaten path a little bit. But It was the best club. It was amazing.
Really?
Yeah. It was, because it had on one side there was a disco, because disco was really happening.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then the other side was the greatest rock club ever, with the whole wall was the PA. Oh. It was just like, you just get blasted.
Right.
I saw Judas Priest there.
Oh, cool. At the Starwood.
Yeah, early on.
Wasn't VH one of the house band at the Starwood for a while? Or weren't they kind of playing there quite
often? I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there was so many startup bands, and there was no... You know, no one was a big star, you know. And Judas Priest was like, you know, amazing. But
Judas Priest coming to town, yeah.
But they still were, I mean, this was a club, you know, that they were playing. So they hadn't broke
yet. But there was such a scene, though, at that time.
There was, but it was the end of the 70s and the beginning of what was about to happen. So that transition, I always say it transitions about 2 years into each decade from the other one.
So to about 81, 82, it was still kind of that late 70s.
It was
70s
still
vibe.
A lot of the 70s stuff. You know, all that, all the bands that had made it up to arena. I mean, I saw Blue Oyster Cult in an arena probably, I don't know, 10, 15 times.
Yeah.
And then that transition happened. And when that, you know, that end of the 70s transition.
So what exactly, like being there and seeing it, what exactly started happening to cause that?
It was probably... the new wave British heavy metal, you know, that whole kind of thing. They started something that was took a long time to trickle over. You know, we bought all our records import, you know, right, and it just took so long for it to trickle over, even though those bands had been together in it since the, what's like 77, you know. Mm-hmm. And then, but when they started changing their sounds, when the Scorpions changed their sound, and when Iron Maiden changed a little bit, and when Judas Priest adapted a few different things, they all kind of changed their sound at the same time.
Right.
You know, they found their their master volume on their Marshalls or something, and they went into that metal grinding.
And the dual
sound.
Guitar leads was really starting to become a thing, right?
That whole thing, and mixing it with singers who can sing, you know, which was pretty amazing, you know, because that was, for me, that was so influential, because, you know, I loved Queen and all those bands, but to have a heavier music added to
with
it was
that.
Just, you know, and so, you know, everybody flocked here.
Who were some of your favorite singers, or like when you were first getting into music? Like the influences on you, I guess.
Well, probably the main one was Ian Gillan. I heard Child in Time for the first time, and I was like, hairs went back of my neck. Just like, what is this kind of opera scream
thing? Yeah.
So much emotion to it. I just was like, I want to figure out how to do that, you know? And then Glenn Hughes came around. I really
Another
loved Glenn Hughes.
Too,
But, you know, Robin Zander was a big one, too.
Chaos just slapped me in the face. So Xander as well, because when we were talking earlier about Bowie and Kiss, it's like Lizzie Borden, band name, but also you as the singer being the namesake, you had there was always a lot of different characters involved, and it seemed like, you know, whereas Bowie had Aladdin Sane and had Ziggy Stardust, you kind of had that as well throughout the years of always kind of playing a different character. Or different elements of a character on each album. When did you decide that you wanted to go that way?
Well, even creating the first one, you know, the Lizzie character, I didn't want it to be... At that time, most people had kind of didn't really hear about the original Lizzie Borden axe killer, you know?
Yeah.
So...
and that was
Borden,
the famous. Lizzie Borden grabbed an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks or whatever it was.
So at that time, that kind of washed away, you know? And so the name was just a weird name. It was like Jethro Tull or something
like Alice
else.
Cooper.
Yeah.
Female,
so,
male name.
Yeah. So no one really put the two and two together until actually when they started putting movies out and stuff. But...
Were you a fan of the Lizzie Borden, or where'd you
No, I just like the name and the imagery, and I thought, okay, that's my starting point.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't actually do any research. I still haven't to this day. I don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
And I wanted it that way because I thought that would be so one-dimensional to do it that way and just cater to everything. You know, I brought the axe on stage, but really mostly because we were watching a lot of bad horror movies, you know, rather B and C movies.
Yeah.
And the axe was more weird, you know, the first Lovey to Pieces, Murderous Metal, that was all about B horror films. We were trying to bring that. It wasn't any, had nothing to do with the original thing, you know. So creating characters seemed so natural to me to be able to, you know, if I was going to make, I don't call what I make concept albums, I make it conceptual, you know, so they're all the songs tie together, but. And you could probably write a script, you know, and I have, but I wanted it to be loose, and I wanted the songs to stand up each individual song instead of having to have the other part of the thing to tell the story. You know, I wanted it, all the songs to
sure.
be individual.
But when you're talking about, too, that time frame, how things were changing, and plus L.A., like 84, 85, there's so many metal bands when heavy metal became a thing. But you guys, right off the bat, you had you talked about the Murderous Metal Roadshow, and there was a lot of gimmickry and visual things and stunts. And go into that process and how you started to do that and why you started to do that.
Well, originally, when you know, I had gone to see so many bands, I felt that was my college. I had to go see what not to do, and that was like. Every night I went out to see who I didn't want to do and who I didn't want to be.
You mean some of the newer bands that were on the strip? And that sort of
even
thing?
Some of the older bands, you know, just the way that they did it. How was I going to do it, you know, and how I wanted to do it. And when I saw Kiss, I saw them so in character on stage. They never broke character.
Mm-hmm.
And same with Cooper and the same with the Tubes and
There's an underrated stage show act. Yeah. People don't realize how much of a show they had.
Oh my God. It was massive. Yeah. And, you know, they did so many, and Fee played so many characters on stage.
I didn't know that. The singer. Yeah.
Yeah. He was, he had a guy that looked just, he was Dee Snider.
Oh,
he looked just like Dee Snider. It was called Quaalude.
He put the wig on
the whole thing, but this is before Twisted Sister, right? Or probably right around the same time, mm-hmm. I guess. But it was, you know, he played a lot of characters on stage. So I thought that, okay, if I'm going to do this, I want to be in character. I want to be full on. And I thought that would be so much, and it was easier for me too, because I couldn't even get in front of a classroom.
Oh, so you're a shy guy?
Yeah, I was like, if they made me stand in front of the class, I would take the fail. You know? So being in character was, to me, just was like, okay, that's it. When I see Gene Simmons in full character, I was like, I can do that, you know. I can find, but I, you know, it took me years to figure it out where I wanted to take it. You know, I went to one extreme to the other, trying to figure out which was more natural and what was put on. You know,
tell me about some of the stunts that you had at that time.
Well, because the PMRC was around, you know, we went from the horror stuff, and I didn't want to be stuck in there, so we went right out of that when we did the Menace record. And I wanted it to be like a futuristic gang, you know, like the
Clockwork Orange.
Yeah,
type thing,
yeah, I mixed a lot of the imageries of a lot of different crazy movies. Mm-hmm. But I saw, you know, obviously the Walking Dead that's out now. You know, that was kind of what I was thinking way back then. Mm. And to have this gang and have this one general, which I called Stiletto, which was me, mm-hmm. and he controlled this, you know, gang of marauders. And that was kind of the way it was. But because the PMRC was around, I kind of threw them in there because we were on the filthy list every single time they put one out. But we didn't get I didn't get the fame from it. I just got knocked out of the record stores.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Let's talk about that quickly, these little details. So the PMRC was the Parental Music Resource Center, and they would put out a list of bands that you kids were not supposed to listen to. Yeah. Is that kind of the vibe?
It was Filthy 15, I think it was called. And I was on it every single time. And, you know, D and Wasp and a couple of bands were getting a lot of notoriety. But I wasn't getting the notoriety. I was just getting knocked out of the record stores.
So record stores would actually look at this list and take your album out.
Exactly.
That's insane to think about that. It was almost like a form of communism.
It was crazy.
Wow.
And most of those bands, you know, they got a lot out of it, mm-hmm. you know. But the ones down on the bottom of that list, that's the ones who...
You wouldn't get the kids rebelling against their parents and buying it anyways, because...
Yeah, we just got they just stopped us from doing it. We've been raided by the Vice Squad so many times. We're on stage, all of a sudden the lights come on, Vice Squad comes in, they think that I was gonna, you know, destroy all their kids or brainwash all their kids, and they just closed our show.
You're kidding me. So Vice Squads would actually come to your
in
shows
in multiple states?
Really?
Is
there one you can remember in particular?
Probably the one that was the most intense was in San Diego. We were playing in I was in full character, blood everywhere. And this particular, the show was very underage. There were probably 13, 14-year-old kids, and they were just loving it, you know. And but they came in like they were the Gestapo. And they were, like the place was on fire. Hmm. They were just getting the kids out as fast as they could possibly get them out, because any 1 second longer of... me brainwashing them, you know,
destroy their minds forever.
Yeah. So and they threatened to arrest me and everything else, and it was just it all happened in in just a blink of an eye, just, you know. But that it happened to us multiple times.
And what would they say to you, like, just get off the stage, or you're lucky we don't arrest you, or
Yeah, I mean, there was a couple. Most of the time, the promoter would jump in front of us and say, what's going on? Why are you doing this? And because it came out of nowhere, you know. We would get a couple newspaper things that we were coming, and that's all it took. As soon as they knew we were coming, that, you know. So that stuff didn't get a lot, you know.
You didn't get the press
from it. I didn't get the press from it. Yeah. I didn't get the stuff that a lot of people got, you know, that actually helped them. All they did was take our records out of the record store.
So you talked about, like you said, you were covered in blood. So tell me about some of the stuff that you would do on stage at the beginning. Because I remember you weren't cutting the heads off of, but there was some magical tricks with chicks in a box, and there was a lot of different stuff like that.
We did a lot of different things. I mean, at the beginning, there was the guy who did Troll, the movie. Mm-hmm. He was right next to us. And he used to make all the troll dolls and everything.
Next to you in rehearsal or something?
Yeah, right next to our rehearsal. Okay. So I would go in there and I'd go, what can we do in the show? What do you got? And so he made my costume at that time. And then he also made, we were doing a thing with you know, from Splatterfix, where the girl runs and, you know, Jason's behind her, you know, tracking her. So I wanted to do that on stage in the best way that we could. And then eventually cut her head off. Mm. And so that was the first one that we worked on. And he built this whole thing where as soon as I chopped the head, blood would shoot out. And I go, well, you know what? We're playing the Troubadour. And I wanted to hit the second story.
Just so, a smaller club with a second story on top, yeah.
So we had a fire extinguisher hookup, and we just cranked that thing. And it was just blood everywhere. Wow. And this was before anybody was shooting blood out.
Sure. I
mean, no one was doing it. Not, you know, Wasp started like a month before we did, but they were throwing meat. Mm-hmm. You know, we were shooting blood more than, you know.
What would the Troubadour, like, bosses say to this?
They didn't say anything. They didn't care because they saw this movement happening. But it went from Troubadour was a supper club with Elton John and all these folk bands.
Right. Yeah.
And all of a sudden, they brought in the heavy metal guys and, you know, when we started playing, they had tables and chairs set up. Hmm. So people would be eating dinner watching us play. And it was a supper club.
Yeah.
And until we started drawing enough so then they would take the chairs and tables out. But the first time we did the blood routine, blood just shot, I mean, over everybody was covered in it. And like I said, it was back then, they were in shock. Even fans who came to see us were just shocked because they were covered in blood. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not something like now where you see Guar do it and everything.
Sure.
Now, I mean, back then they were in just shell shocked, going, "What just happened? Do I have animal blood? Do I have human blood?"
Yeah.
They had no idea. So it was such a true shock rock because nothing had come before. You saw Cooper do a vaudeville version of it, but he really wasn't shooting blood in the crowd.
Yours is more violent, more horrific.
Yeah, it was over the top, and it was based on all those horror movies that we used to watch. And then when the PMRC thing, we wanted to have a routine. I remember this one where a PMRC guy was trying to stop our show. So we dressed one of our roadies in a suit and tie, and he came out. And he had big signs saying "No Lizzie Borden" with the, you know, Lizzie Borden with the thing
line,
crossed,
circle line through it. Yeah.
And then I would get him on his knees and take a pistol and I shot him in the head and his head, whole head of it would blow off. And I had that same troll guy made that too.
So what would they do? Put like a prosthetic piece on the back?
With
every night.
Every night the roadie had to dress in his suit, put the hair piece. And then I would shoot him, and the head would blow off.
Would he pull a trigger or something that would make it go?
Yeah, there was someone that would rig that at the same time that I would shoot him, and we would aim it right at the audience. So the blood would shoot right out of the back of his head, right into the crowd. And that was one. And then, you know, we've done a lot of different types of things. Any idea that I came up with, we tried to figure out how to recreate it on stage the best way that we could.
From a financial standpoint, if you have to put the squib on the back of a guy's head, I'm sure that's not the cheapest thing to do if you're doing 50 gigs or whatever.
It wasn't. It was extremely difficult, especially back then, you know. And we were, you know, I remember on the first tour, we were touring and Slayer was in front of us. And they had a thing for destroying everything. And they destroyed every motel room. on the scene, on the circuit, and we would come in there and they said, no, no rooms. So we didn't get rooms for most of that tour because every place we went in, Slayer had already destroyed the rooms and they said, no more rock bands. So we were just so, we were so sleep deprived and doing this routine, you know, there was a couple of times where I almost knocked my teeth out because I'm just so sleep deprived, you know.
On like the nightstand or something?
Well, or I'd take the baseball bat and hit the sign would come and hit me in the face. Gotcha. or you know, low ceilings or something. You know, we had so many different things, but being sleep deprived actually helped with the character because I was so in the zone, you know. So, you know, I just kind of used all these, you know, we didn't have the money to do it the right way when there's no five-star hotels that was even resembling.
Maybe 5 nights in a row you could get a combined 5 stars, 1 star each for one night, if that.
Oh, we had one where there were spiders throughout the whole thing. We had to run out.
Giant spiders chasing you. So you talk about the shock rock things that you were doing at that time frame. Did that help build your name fairly quickly, or did you get a pretty big buzz from that?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, the best thing that ever happened to me was we were signed to Metal Blade, but Metal Blade also had a deal with a label called Enigma. And Enigma had a full staff.
Sure, that was a fairly major indie label.
Yeah, they had a full staff, and Metal Blade had a very small staff.
Right.
So they had a publicist named Lisa Gladfelter, and she took a liking to what I was trying to pull off and what I was trying to do. And she was the one who actually made it. You wouldn't have heard of me without her. She was the one who just drove it, got me in every magazine, got me every night of the week we were out doing red carpet stuff. I mean, we were constantly, the machine was so gung-ho there, and she was really the one who drove it, you know.
Right.
Get me in every picture, get, you know. And that started to go, you know, go to Europe and Japan and other places just because of that press that she got for me. So that was like the main way to get my name out. We were touring like crazy, but you know, we were doing clubs.
Sure.
That's a minimal amount of
right. You know. Did you ever do any major tours with major bands? I can't ever recall.
No, we never got it. There was 5 bands up for the tour, and we were always one of the 5. And we'd always never.
You're talking about like Priest or Maiden or Motley Crue or whoever was big at the time.
Yeah, I think I remember we were confirmed for a Cooper tour. I think it's Comeback.
Oh, wow,
in 85.
Right.
And they said, you're the support. And we were like, but it didn't start for like 6 weeks. So we're just waiting. And our album started slipping out of the top 200. And once it slipped out, we were off the tour.
Gone, right.
And they replaced us with, I don't know who, somebody. You know.
But even like video-wise, I know there was a video for Me Against the World, but I can't think of something from any of the, like from Love You to Pieces. Did you guys have a video? You know, you're trying to think about that. I
we did
recall.
A... our own home video in our studio. Someone came in and filmed us and they went to edit it. But it, I forget what, maybe we did something with that. It was Give Them the Axe.
That
song. But other than that, you know, video wasn't even heard of. Even the live video that we did, I was the one who came to Metal Blade and said, look, you know, I see other people starting to do these live videos. And this was '84, you know, the end of '84, '85. And so we put that together with no money and figured out how to do it. It was a one night shot too. And we were coming back from that sleep deprived tour and that was the last night of the tour. And so it was just one shot. You know, there wasn't, you know, we didn't think about recording during the sound check to have some safety trying to do 2 nights. You know, it was just like, okay, do it. One night's gotta be perfect.
Here we go.
So what you hear is what happened.
Really? So no overdubs on that or anything like that?
There was
minimal.
Yeah, there was like three or four little pieces where the guitar was screwed up or something, and we fixed that. So,
but vocally, it was pretty straightforward.
What you hear is what was on there, and it was like, you know, I'm trying to do all the theatrics and everything. I wasn't thinking about it, you know.
Which is hard, because when you talk to, like, I talked to Paul Stanley about Alive last year. It was the 40th anniversary, and he was saying, like, you know, of course, a lot of it was recorded after the fact, because when you're on stage and you got 7-inch platform heels and there's bombs going off and you're putting on a show and you're dancing, it's not going to be perfect. It doesn't even sound good sometimes, but you didn't have that option.
Well, you know what? If I had known that, if I had known a lot of stuff, I would have done it. I would have said, hell yeah, let's make it perfect. You know, but back then we were trying to be real, you know, and I didn't want to tune down. I wanted to do it. I felt like everything was a cop out. So you know, I was kind of crazy back then. It was, let's just do it for real, you know. And some people liked it, but for the most part, I think that if I had made it better, more people would have liked it. You know, and I don't think we got really respect for doing a one night off thing, you know.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So it wasn't,
you didn't get that indie cred.
There wasn't, we didn't really get anything from that being, you know, steadfast and saying we're real, you know, no one cared. So
did you do like tours nationwide at that point in time?
Yeah, we were just looping the US.
But just you guys.
We were mostly headlining everywhere we went, and that was a good thing. I mean, especially when Visual Eyes came out, we were able to do real headlining tours in front of people instead of, you know, the first couple, you know, was a hit and miss. We'd play in front of, you know, 800 people, and then the next night we'd play in front of 20, you know, so it was like, okay, what's going on here? And we figured out certain states, they heard of us, and other states they didn't.
Yeah.
But when Visual Eyes came out, we were able to do that in every state, and that was kind of a game changer.
Just on Me Against the World.
Just on, just the video alone. You know, I hosted Headbangers Ball for one night, and I got a lot of exposure from that. And, you know, the video got played on Headbangers Ball all the time. So it was one of those things where that was the game changer.
Yeah.
And it was meant to be. I mean, you know, when I, after we had done the first two records and got minimal success, I was like, there has to be a change here. We've got to do something. We've got to write better songs. And at the time, we had no understanding of how to do that. You know, there was no tempo control. There was no volume control. My voice was high only because I had to sing over the top of the music.
That's an interesting point. Because back in those days, there was real no monitors, no inner ears.
No.
So to be heard
in our studio, anytime I wrote anything that was middle of the road, it was just a wash.
Wow.
Couldn't hear it. So I had to sing above. And once I was singing that high, I kind of got stuck there.
It was a Geddy Lee type territory.
Yeah, I was. I was in that territory, and it was the only way to hear myself. And then when I hear myself on the record, I'm like, well, that's kind of unnecessary. I don't need to go into that stratosphere.
Right.
So I started to, I was into David Bowie, so I really started to sing along to David Bowie stuff to try and develop some low tones. And then we went to do the Visual Eyes record. I actually wanted to do a lot of that stuff, but Max didn't want to do it.
It was Max Norman.
Yeah, he was like, you know, just stay in the range, you know. I brought it down, but nowhere near where I wanted to. What I ended up doing on Visual Eyes, it's like 7 octaves. I went the full gamut. I was singing so low, and I was singing so high throughout you know, all the harmonies and stuff. So that record, I was able to do all the stuff that I had worked on.
Which made it more accessible probably to a bigger fan base.
It was. It's the biggest record. Master of Skies were our biggest record. But it was also the end of the
whole line, thing. Right?
Yeah, it was the end of it. We toured until 93, and we were still, you know, headlining clubs and still drawing really well, but it was the end, you know, and everybody could feel it.
Just because the musical climate had changed?
It had, and promoters were starting to promote, you know, to try and getting more in grunge bands and stuff like that, and that whole movement. We were still able to tour, and I could have carried on, but I felt if I wasn't going up, I didn't want to just go around, you know? So I just kind of just stepped back. And
Was that hard? Because that was basically the whole scene. You know, even the big bands were feeling it at that time frame.
Yeah, and everyone, you know, some bands tried to change. And I was like, oh man, I want to grow. I don't necessarily want to
You don't need the Lizzie Borden industrial album. Right? Yeah.
And I saw some other bands doing that too, you know, I'm like, okay, that didn't really work. So, you know, I like to add things. I like to create new things, but I didn't want to have to change because the scene changed. Mm-hmm. Like I said, early on, I mean, we were never part of any club. You know, we were never part of any, you know, all the thrashers were over here and all the glamours were over here and we were in the middle.
You had elements of both, yeah.
And I didn't want to have to join any one of these clubs. Mm-hmm. So it was me against the world because I really had no, you know, I didn't want to. Even some of the bands were like, let's pick a side.
Yeah.
I'm like, why do I have to pick a side? You know?
Interesting, yeah. If you would have picked a side, it might have been easier to lump together.
It would have been so much easier. It would have been so much easier. I mean, if I would have gone thrash, probably would have been really easy, especially being on Metal Blade, who was catering to more of the, you know, extreme bands.
When you're talking about some of the bands that you mentioned, Alice, but a band that was kind of at your level when it started talking about Wasp, did you ever kind of go check them out and kind of like nick stuff from each other or what to stay away from?
My influences were the 70s, so I was definitely taking from Cooper and Kiss and the Tubes and just, you know, because I didn't know what I was doing, so I was just borrowing what they did and, until I could figure it out for myself. Mm-hmm. And once I figured it out, then I would abandon what I borrowed. As far as what was happening around us, I don't know. I thought it was kind of a healthy thing because everyone had their own thing. Blackie was chopping up meat and flinging it.
Yeah, right.
And I thought that
saw blade.
Yeah. I mean, I went to the Troubadour to see him and there was like 40 people. There was no one there. And he's flinging meat and people were flinging the meat back at him. And I'm like, that's interactive, you know. Yeah.
It's meat throwing.
Yeah. It was such an interesting idea. It's not something I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what I did was splatter blood on him, you know. And I thought that was my contribution.
Did you guys all like hang out? Because there were so many bands back then. Or did you ever kind of just see dudes at the bar some nights and hang out? Or would you go out?
Yeah. I mean, the Rainbow was like the place.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go to the Rainbow when it was the more of the end of the 70s. And it was still had the glam rock theme going. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, everyone had their faces painted. You know, all the girls were all, you know, decked out.
Mm-hmm.
And then that went back then in, you know, when everybody, all the guys were in colored suits, you know, like Rod Stewart or something. And then that all went to overnight, you know, with probably around 81, 82, it all went to black leather jackets and girls wearing all black and, you know, black makeup. And so that, I've been friends with a lot of people from all those different bands, and we always hung out at the Rainbow, you know, so it was one of those things where I liked it because everyone sounded different. You know, it wasn't until probably 87 or 88 where the duplicate bands came in and they sounded just like the hit band. You know, but before that, everyone kind of had their own sound and no one was trying to mooch off of anybody else. And it, that was really healthy at the time too, especially since we had to compete with all the great UK bands.
Mm.
You know, they had their sounds and they were all individual too. So we were trying to we're emulating them, but put our own stamp on it, especially lyrically, you know. So it was a pretty good back and forth there for a little while until the duplicate bands came in.
So we talked about this before, about the decline of the Western civilization. Like when you think about Lizzie Borden's exposure in the 80s, that could be your biggest moment as far as being one of the featured bands on this very critically acclaimed documentary. How did that come about?
It was probably through Lisa Gladfelter. But, we were red hot at the time
in LA,
everywhere. Yeah, Visualize was red hot. It was it was in the top 100. It was doing really well, and this is competing with bands who were putting $1 million into their thing. We were competing with that when we had no money at all. So it was it was an unbelievable achievement to be able to be in this on the same playing field as some of these bands where the labels are putting it in, you know, there was all kind of reports, $2 or $3 million into promoting albums.
Right.
And ours was probably $200 or $300.
Come on, Slagle. Would you ever talk to Brian about that? Or
he always just said the same thing, you know, those are major labels and this is what it is. And, and he's got his model on the way he does things.
His business model, right?
Yeah, and it doesn't really matter if the band's going through the roof. There's no more money going to be thrown at it, you know? It's just about let the people, you know, find it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And if you can't get them to find it, they're not going to find it, you know? So, yeah, I mean, but...
We're talking about how you guys were red hot and when they...
Yeah, we were red hot, and then she, and then the director,
Penelope
contacted us, and I met with her a couple of times, and we got on really well. And she was, and she had, she didn't really, I don't think she understood what kind of movie she was making at the beginning.
How do you mean?
Because when she first talked to me about it was more of a celebration, you know, and I thought Motley Crue in a hot tub, you know, going down Sunset Strip. I thought that's what she was trying to
capture. Yeah.
And so that whole time I, you know, and I had gone back for like, I don't know, 3 or 4 voiceovers and were, you know, and cause while she was making the movie during the duration, but we played on Halloween night in Pasadena, a place where Van Halen used to play all the time, called Perkins Palace. And, it was our last LA show, I think, for the tour. And they came down and filmed the whole thing. And so she cut up that and put it in the movie, filmed us backstage and everything. But it wasn't until much later that, you know, after I came back, she brought me in for voiceovers, and then she started telling me some of the stuff she'd been filming and, you know, where the direction of the movie was going. And it was going more of a, you know, this, it's like, I don't know, it's probably like in the 40s or 50s when people ran to Hollywood to be a movie star. This was the same sort of thing,
yeah.
But in the 80s, and having it be the backdrop being heavy metal music, you know. So everyone was coming here to be a rock star. It was the same, that's the kind of direction that she started gravitating toward. And that, and so I was like, when I saw the movie, you know, finally I was like, what is this? It was so opposite of what I thought was going to be. But I understood it. She, you know, she was trying to, you know, see.
She told that story.
She told that story about these people running to Hollywood to be a star. You know, it's the same old story, just a different decade and in different format. And so I understood why she went that way.
I think you guys came, it looked pretty good, came out of it looking pretty good.
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, we didn't do too badly.
Besides all the other bands on there, I think you guys were probably, besides Megadeth played, but then you guys would be right underneath that as far as you had some success.
She ended up having to cut. She had us featured even more in that movie, but because she got Aerosmith and
Kiss
Alice, and Cooper, yeah. As soon as she got all the big names and Ozzy and everything, they had to cut us down. But we were really going to be the feature band.
Oh wow! Okay.
She had in the first draft, it was mostly us. So because, you know, she filmed us backstage doing all kind of crazy things and you know, that whole show and everything. So, and like I said, I did a lot of voiceover stuff. But she ended up cutting us out a lot, which I was happy about. I was all right. You know what? We got out. We got in and we got out.
You got out alive. did that help when the movie came out? Did it?
It did. It did. I mean, everywhere we went, people had seen that movie. Still to this day.
Yeah, it's a classic.
We went to South America. We went to South Korea. Everyone knows us from that movie. It actually, you know, it's done more so now than it did even back then.
It was hard to find back then too. Like,
yeah. Now it's been on TV a lot, you know.
It's video on demand. They just re-released it.
Yeah.
It was the whole thing. I remember like growing up in Canada, if you were able to see it somehow, someone would have like a bootleg copy on VHS. It's like, check this out. This is great, you know?
And so, yeah, I mean, so now it's, I mean, everywhere we go, people talk about it, you know, and it's even people that never, they don't know me at all, except for that movie.
Yeah, right, right. Did you ever meet up with Alice or Paul Stanley or anybody like that and talk to them about kind of being a shock rock guy? Get advice or anything?
Well, I've had a few conversations with Cooper. We played with him once. He came and he was really cool after we played. We played the Orange Pavilion in like 86. And he came over to our dressing room and started talking to us, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then we both played the Reading Festival in the UK the next year. And they had a big party at a place called the Limelight. Metallica was everybody.
Famous place,
everybody was there. It was a big party. And me him and we're talking, I think we talked about golf and stuff, but me, him, and another guy named Marilyn. It was before Marilyn Manson. It was another rock star.
Like an English guy called
an
Marilyn,
English
right?
guy.
Yeah, like a culture club type thing.
Yeah. I can't remember what the name of the band was, but he was called Marilyn. Mm. And they took a picture of us three and put us on the front cover of whatever the London newspaper was, mm-hmm. and said, what do these three guys have in common? We all had female
chick names, yeah.
So it was pretty, that was pretty cool. But yeah, I mean, I've had conversations with Gene Simmons as well. He's called me a couple of times when he was interested in us.
Interested in like managing you or?
Well, it's hard to understand what he was talking about because he's so, you know, kind of crazy.
Cryptic sometimes, right?
Yeah. He's not going to commit to anything,
mm-hmm.
but he called me on a couple occasions to trying to work with me in some way, and he wanted me to sign a lifetime deal. And I had read a book that was written about David Bowie, and he had signed a lifetime deal, and him and Elvis were the only two people to sign to give away 50% of their
the publishing, thing, or...
which was all illegal, you know. Oh. But it happened. And so I had already read that book, and I'm like, you know what? I can't sign a lifetime deal with anyone. I have fear of commitment. So I said, I'll sign a 5-year deal.
Yeah.
And then he said, no, I want a lifetime deal.
But a lifetime deal for what, Gene?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, what are you offering me?
Are you offering me a management?
Yeah.
Well, no. What do you want? You just want to get anything I make, but not have anything to do with me.
Yeah.
So, and he was supposed to produce the Menace record, actually, and it didn't happen because he wasn't going to be there.
Mm.
He said that, you know, he was going to do the record, but he wouldn't be there. And I said, well, just put your name on it doesn't really help me. You know, we needed something.
But in his mind, he thought it would help you.
Yeah. And then I think it was around the Master of Disguise, he came in again as a producer.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same thing, he said, you know, I'll do pre-production and then my guy will take over. And I said, I don't want that. I go, I need to learn how to make better records. And I can't do it if the guy that's teaching me is not there.
Right.
You know? So I bypassed on that too. So yeah, I mean, it was Gene. It was the whole thing. It's a weird thing that I have no idea what was going on. I only have I still have it on tape of him calling me and leaving a message. You know, I always had my machine on, and all of a sudden, you know, I would just hear who it is. Hello, this is Gene Simmons, and this is the first time, and I'm like, holy shit. Gene Simmons is calling me. He goes, I know you're there. I know you're sleeping. I'm going to call you back in an hour, and you better pick up. And I'm like, holy shit. I have this all on tape, too, still to this day.
Did he call back in an hour?
Yeah, he did, and I was picked it up.
Hello. You mentioned Marilyn, and I was just kind of thinking about, like, there was a couple, like Rob Zombie, for example, and Marilyn Manson, that sort of thing. Kind of a modern day version of what Alice was doing and what Lizzie Borden was doing. Did those guys ever, I mean, do you feel like you're a pioneer in this sort of a vibe? Have you ever kind of got any shout outs from them in any way?
No, and probably never. I mean, I believe that I was, mm-hmm. you know, I was doing something when, you know, even when we started, Cooper was on a 5-year hiatus.
Yeah. Yeah. He was a mess at that time too. Right.
He was retired for all accounts and no one really knew if he was ever coming back.
Right.
And the Tubes had kind of got rid of the show,
mm-hmm.
and they were kind of doing this
where she's
top
a beauty
40
type thing. Yeah.
And you know, all there was Kiss,
but even they had dropped the makeup pretty much in 83.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? So it was, I was out there alone doing this, you know, holding the torch, you know, keeping it going. But yeah, I don't think any of those people would ever say anything.
Right. But you know, a lot of them are old school metal fans. Sure they've known, you know.
Maybe, but I don't think they would ever say it.
When you talk about Master of Disguise and then kind of how things kind of bottomed out in 93, there's a big resurgence right now for heavy metal in Europe, especially around this time over the last 5 or 6 years. Have you kind of had a resurgence over there as well for Lizzie Borden?
Well, it's almost different than a resurgence because we found a new audience.
Mm.
And so it's not...
You've never been there too much before?
In Europe?
Yeah, you hadn't been there much?
Well, when we started really doing a lot more there. We had been trying to tour the U.S., and the U.S. was getting increasingly more expensive and difficult to do it. And so when we went to, we played a couple of festivals in Europe and saw the reaction and was like, oh my God, you know, what is this? So then we started booking tours there. So all through the 2000s, we've been in Europe and constantly just doing what we used to do in the States in the 80s. We were doing that in Europe. And that's what we have been doing up until this day.
Mm-hmm.
But the last tour that we did in 2014, I think was the last one we did there. And it was all kids, no 80s fans at all.
Hmm.
Almost, you know, there's very few. And it was just like, what is this? This is, and they're, you know, the kids are so enthusiastic.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt like it did at the beginning, you know, when we played in front of these crazy kids that were so hyped and so into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you play for an older 80s crowd, they just nod their head a little bit.
They're older now.
They're older now. And it's midnight. It's like, come on, yeah. Get on with it.
Got to catch the train home.
But the kids are so into it. And so that last run that we did was so exciting for me. I was loving it, going, wow, this is a whole new beginning for us, you know. And so that's why I decided it was time to make a record. You know, I want to make a record for this new fan base that we have. Mm-hmm. We kind of have it around the world too. We had it in South America too. It was all young kids. And in South Korea, we played in Japan.
Wow.
All young kids. And it was just so interesting.
Well, let me ask you this. So you talked about back, you know, when you had to get the squib, putting the guys in the back of the guy's head. And now here we are in 2016, you're doing these shows. Do you use some modern technology for some of your stuff on stage? Do you still do kind of that stuff on stage?
Well, because, you know, throughout the years, you come up with different things. Other bands have come up with things. And sometimes it gets over the top silly.
Mm-hmm.
And it was silly back then, but it was fun.
Yeah.
As long as fun superseded silly, we were all good. But when it got less fun and just silly, then, you know, when you don't have the money to do the prop the right way,
you become a parody of yourself.
Yeah, it became something. So I had to get rid of a lot of the sillier stuff, you know, even though it was fun to do, and bring it into more of a real thing. Like, you know, Gwar's already done what we did in the early 80s and take it to the next level. And so I figured I don't want to do that, you know. So what I try to do is bring it back to a one-on-one type of thing, even if I'm playing in front of, you know, 50,000 people. I wanted, how can I bring this blood routine back in a way that would work? And I remember watching Omen. There's always a horror theme behind my madness.
The Omen, classic.
But when they go fox hunting, and, you know, that was the first time I had ever heard of when you kill your first fox, you get blooded.
Oh, Omen 3, yeah.
And so, you know, you wipe the blood on the cheek. And I figured, oh, that is really cool because I'm playing in front of a lot of young kids who've never seen us before. This is their first time. So I want to kind of initiate them into what they're seeing. So we did a song called There Will Be Blood Tonight. And I would go out in the audience and blood as many people as I could in a 3.5 minute song.
Wow. So you would have a rag with blood on it?
No, just I'd have a bucket of blood and just reach my hand in and just do as many as I can, and everybody wants it.
Yeah, sure.
So it was such a great thing to be able to go right into the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And after I did that, I started seeing more and more people going into the crowd. But, you know, as far as singers and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it worked for me in such a great way that it's hard to not do it now.
Right, yeah, it's a great idea.
Because I've done it all over the world, and it always is the same reaction. Everybody wants it.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants to have that initiation. And even if they've seen us before, they want it again, you know. So it was one of those things where I brought down from the squibs and, you know, and all the big production behind it down to just a human level way of interacting with no money and take the silliness out of it, even though it is still kind of silly, but it's fun.
Yeah, sure. It's funny on the Book of Souls tour that Iron Maiden just did. There's a scene during when Eddie comes out and Bruce reaches in, he actually pulls out the heart of Eddie, and throws it in the crowd, and it is the most cheesy looking thing. But because it's Iron Maiden,
yeah,
it's absolutely amazingly awesome. And if you're able to, because if you catch that heart,
oh my god!
But that's a perfect example of like, this is so not good, but it's good because it's Iron Maiden, exactly. and they're in on the joke.
Yes,
you know, Bruce laughing about it. But yeah, if you were actually a real satanic metal band or something, it would just look like crap.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's the whole thing. Are you in on it?
Yeah.
Even when seeing Kiss, you have to buy into the premise
yes.
of these guys doing what they're doing. If you don't buy into it, then it's silly.
Mm-hmm.
You
know? Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I bought into it completely. I loved it. You know, and I loved real bands like Aerosmith and other, you know, bands that were just saying, okay, it's all about the music
for us. Yeah.
I love that too, but I was able to buy into the premise of theatrical bands. And like for me, it was so much more fun to do it rather than just going up and playing a rock star, you know.
So even when you're talking about like an Appointment with Death and Deal with the Devil, which was the two records you did in the 2000s, you kind of had a theme, like a character. You mentioned Stiletto, and I know you had one for the Visualize guy or whatever, but will you do something like that for the new record, kind of recreate again?
I don't know. When I first started making this record, I said, I'm just not going to be a conceptual record at all. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to try and write 9 or 10 great songs that I like. And that was kind of my idea behind it. But as I started writing the lyrics, I started realizing that there is an underlying theme. And I try to tackle at least one subject on each thing, like Deal with the Devil is about religion.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was an Appointment with Death of like a different way to die every song.
I played death, you
gotcha,
know,
right.
So and death was inserted into everything, even love, you know, death of love, mm-hmm. you know, all that stuff. So I was able to insert that character. So this one, I'm writing about love, but not, you know, I'm writing about everything that's on the subgenre of love, which is jealousy, which is, you know, all those subgenres of love, you know, to try and make it so interesting. And I've never done that before. I've written about love before, but under different circumstances, not all in one encompassing thing. So,
love you to pieces. Love is a crime.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Love kills.
Yeah, that's right. Another good one. Jesus, a bunch.
So yeah, I've done it, but and this one is a little different because I'm singing a little different. I'm doing lots of vocals on this one. I wanted to not compete with the guitar on this. Mm. I decided, you know, this is going to be about the song. Every song is going to be just the song. It's not going to be a song showcasing a guitar solo or showcasing a guitar riff. It was all about the vocals and the song. And so that's what this album is. That's why I kind of focused in on it. I wanted to take ego off the table. Mm-hmm. I wanted to take someone's talent off the table.
What's best for the vibe of the song?
Yeah, whatever the song should write itself.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where things have gone. With
something
so
you learn over years of recording. We're on our 7th record now too, and you realize after a while, it's all about the song, man.
It
does not matter if there's a scream or a great solo. What's the chorus? What's the hook? And
exactly.
That's all that matters, right?
The hook is everything, and that's what you're going to be known for.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the live show. It's not. It's always going to be, like, back to the beginning, you know, I'm known for Me Against the World.
Right.
I'm trying to write another one that I could be known for. But that's so hard. I mean, everyone's trying to do that. Kiss has been trying to do it. Everyone's trying to do it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, even if you get another top 5 song, it's still, you're going to be known for the song you wrote 20 years ago.
Well, because people grow up with those too. They have life experiences based around them, you know. I think that's always why people like hearing the older songs, even though the newer songs might even be better, but you have more an attachment to those older songs because you have experiences.
Exactly. And then, you know, if a band was running on all cylinders at that time, they happened to click it all. Like Aerosmith can never redo Rocks.
Yeah.
It was just too perfect in the way it was created. They couldn't find that again if their life depended on
right.
it. And so, you know, when you get in that groove and you're the best that band's going to be, and you write that one song, it's hard to rewrite another one.
Sure.
I wrote that one. I can write this one. You can't.
A couple last questions. It's funny you mentioned something that spurred it. So you have actually had 2 guitar players come out of your band. There might even be more, but that basically Joe Holmes goes and joins Ozzy, and then Dario goes and joins Zach, who was in Ozzy. It's like you're kind of a feeding ground for Ozzy guitar players.
Yeah, it's bizarre. It just keeps going. Like, if Zach has a kid, I'll have a guitar player that joins.
That's right, yeah.
I don't know how that happened. Even when Ozzy went solo in the early 80s, that kind of was the bubble that started things to happen in the 80, in Hollywood. Hmm. It was Ozzy looking for a guitar player and doing cattle calls.
Wow.
And every guitar player thought they could be the guitar player. And all there was them to look was Eddie Van Halen. You know, there was Eddie and then all the Eddie
pretenders,
influencers. Yeah. They were influenced by Eddie. So that kind of thing started bubbling. And then Randy gets the gig. But that started other bands to, well, I didn't get that gig, but I'll form my other band, you know? Mm. So some of those people who actually auditioned or thought they could get into that, formed their own bands. And the same thing was happening with lots of other things too. And and once, you know, I think once, you know, a homeboy gets a gig, a big gig, it's this, you know, he got it, we can get it, right. You know? This, you know, because everyone's just circulating in Hollywood, going around in circles. No one was touring at that time. Mm-hmm. Even when we started touring, no bands toured. You know, I think Motley Crue was the only one to get out and do other things. And but you know, we were just a swimming around in the fish pond for a couple of years until I said we have to go out to tour. Mm-hmm. So I borrowed my old band's motorhome and stuck all these people in it, and we took off. We just called clubs and said, we want to play. And they said,
really?
Okay, yeah.
That's what you would do.
Yeah. And well, that first tour, we did it that way. And they went, who are you? We actually went to Canada, too, which was crazy.
Did you get gigs?
Yeah. We played a place called Larry's Hideaway.
In Toronto?
He was in Toronto, yeah. And it was like the troubadour of...
That is a famous place, yeah.
And I remember to this day walking in there and seeing tribute bands. And I'd never seen a tribute band in my life. And there was flyers for tribute bands. And this was probably early 85. And I was like, well, that's really weird. They're pretending to be another
like
band.
A Zeppelin tribute band.
Yeah,
or whatever,
yeah. Yeah. And I had never seen that before. It didn't happen in Hollywood. It was all new acts.
All original. Wow.
All original. Yeah. Yeah.
Which changed quickly.
Changed, oh, yeah.
That's right, huh?
Completely, yeah.
Last question I was going to ask you. So we mentioned Visualize. The album cover for that is pretty crazy. It's you like in a bust out TV, but you're painted completely silver. It didn't look like it was maybe the most comfortable. Where did that come from?
Oh my God. It was, you know, the character, I called him Oblivion. Mm-hmm. And they actually kind of copped my the character creation a couple years later in a movie called Trick or Treat.
Oh.
But my idea for the character was, he would shoot through the TV and he would, you know, infect every TV program and then come back out and then affect real life.
Uh-huh.
So that was kind of what the character, and they eventually did that in that movie. I'm like, what the hell?
They could have at least got you to play Sammy Kerr, right?
Actually, they sent me the script.
Really?
Yeah.
Sammy Kerr was kind of like a goth, kind of evil rock star, kind of looked almost the Lizzie Borden
vibe.
Yeah,
they sent the script to Metal Blade, and I read it, and I was interested, but they ended up going with an actor. Mm-hmm. Imagine that.
Fools.
But anyway... that's how I envisioned the character. So we figured, okay, well, let's get a TV. And I think Mark Weiss did the
famous
cover.
Photographer, yeah.
And we ended up getting two or three TVs and a blowtorch. And we had two or three people dismantling these TVs, gutting the TVs, and blowtorching them. We gutted like two or three TVs, and completely just like the one that's on the cover, just to see which one was the one that we liked. And... So we ended up with that one. And then I started out with just a little bit of silver on my eyes. And that was it. And my hair, you know. And then Mark just said, no, more. So.
You look like the Tin Man.
Joey was actually the one painting me. And I was using, I only used theatrical makeup. I never used Maybelline or anything like that. It was always theatrical makeup. But I was using this silver stuff that probably Ace was probably using because it was. I mean, it just goes right into your skin.
Yeah.
And he had to keep, it was a, you know, it was a probably a, I don't know, 17-hour shoot. And so, but he had to keep just pouring the silver makeup on my face. My skin was just absorbing it. And spraying my hair silver and just, you know, spraying my arm silver. And yeah, it was one of those things where I was in that TV all day long, constantly. There's so many other shots that came from that. And we didn't know, you know, we ended up with the one we had, but it was
it was a long process.
There, almost every cover, I'm being tortured. The Deal with the Devil one, I had to sit on a perch with those giant wings behind me. I mean, that was another 17-hour shoot.
Just on the perch the whole time.
I was on the perch with three girls below me, and we had to have the right pose, and we just kept shooting and shooting until we finally found it. But I'm, you know, all the covers, you know, I suffer.
How did you get your hair so frizzy back in those days? It was like Frizzy Borden was your nickname at times.
It was Frizzy Lizzy. Yeah. It was easy because I did back then. There was no product for men.
Mm-hmm.
It was only for women, and even the glam rockers found Aquanet.
Right. Yeah.
Which was such a bizarre thing, you know, for a man to use Aquanet. Mm-hmm. You know. So and like I said, I only used theatrical makeup, so I didn't really get into any products, and I didn't know anything, so I never used conditioner, not even regular conditioner, nothing. And my hair just got frizzier and frizzier and drier and drier, and I would use a blow dryer and make it even worse.
Yeah.
But I remember being in Japan and trying to blow dry it, and my hair just said no. And it just said no. And it just was, it just finally was, I got to figure something out.
So it said no, and it just went.
It just, it wasn't even a good frizz. It was just done. It was not one drop of moisture in it. So I came back and I talked to somebody, and they said, "Are you using conditioner?" I'm like, "What's that?"
There you go. And now you have a fine, healthy, straight head of hair. A final question. What's your favorite song to play live when you do shows?
Well, the last tour, it was Under Your Skin. Mm-hmm. Because it was a brand new song, which I, you know,
it's a great
tune. You know, you're a singer. You love playing new stuff. You know, I always love to sing new things, but you can't do it unless there's a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And every night that got one of the biggest reactions in the whole show. So it was such a, and it was a song I wrote by myself one night, you know, and it's really dark and in the studio, and it just all came together really mm-hmm. well. So the fact that it translated on stage was beyond a bonus, because I didn't know if it was, I didn't even play it in the first round.
Mm.
You know, we played like seven songs off Appointment with Death live, and I didn't play that one.
Wow. Yeah.
And because I didn't think it would translate. And Joey's like, we got to play that. I'm like, I don't think it's going to work. So then I put it in the show, and it kills, and I end up getting rid of all the other songs. But yeah, it worked all around the world too. I mean, we played it in South Korea, and they went, it was like the biggest reaction of the whole show.
Amazing, right? You think it's South Korea of all places too.
Yeah, it's very strange. In South America as well, same thing, you know. We're thinking they're only gonna really like the old stuff, but that was the biggest reaction of the whole tour.
That's great, man. Yeah,
that was fun for me to be able to sing a brand new song.
Sure, and have people react to it as well.
And that's what I hope to do with the new album. I'm going to, you know, even when we did Master of Disguise, we played 80% of Master of Disguise and just like maybe three old songs.
Wow, yeah.
And we got some flack,
mm-hmm.
but no one wanted us to take out any of the Master of Disguise songs. They just wanted to have the show longer.
Yeah.
So that was, I was like, okay, I'll take the flack as long as
it's a good
you're
problem,
not telling
right.
me not to play the new album.
Right.
You know? And the same thing with Appointment with Death, you know, we played like seven or eight of the songs in the show,
mm-hmm.
but we made the show a little longer. But for this album, I plan on playing the majority of the album live. So we'll see.
Huge revolt. And if that's the case, just spray him with blood and tell him to shut up.
Yeah.
Thanks, dude. All right, thanks to the amazing Lizzie Borden, one of my all-time favorites. His new record is called My Midnight Things. It's his first album in 11 years, available on Metal Blade Records, home of Brian Slagle, a Talk is Jericho alumni. And you can get the record, My Midnight Things, on Apple Music, Amazon, or wherever you buy music. Lizzie will be on the road soon as well.
Follow him on Facebook at Real Lizzie Borden and on the Twitter at Real Lizzie Borden. You won't miss him live. The show is great. Go check him out if you got a chance. Very, very cool to have Lizzie Borden back on the scene. And very cool to have cabins still available for Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea. But they're not lasting for long, all right? Just go to ChrisJerichoCruise.com to book yours now. And we finally have the first round of the Sea of Honor tournament as presented by Ring of Honor. Everybody's talking about it. It's going to be really, really, I think it's going to be a great tournament. And let's see, who do we got on board right now? We got Jay Lethal versus BJ Whitmore. Christopher Daniels, Talk is Jericho alumni, versus Delirious. Marty Scurll versus Rhett Titus. Silas Young versus Flip Gordon. And then the other side of the bracket, Mark Briscoe versus Will Ferrara. Adam Page versus Frankie Kazarian, Talk is Jericho alumni. Cheeseburger, Talk is Jericho alumni, versus Beer City Bruiser. Jay Briscoe versus Kenny King. They're going to be battling it out, and the winner of the Sea of Honor tournament gets a Ring of Honor World Heavyweight Championship title shot, and we got a lot more matches coming. You guys should go check out Being the Elite to see what may or may not be happening with Chris Jericho and the Young Bucks. We might call ourselves the Bucks of Jericho, or is it Y2 Jackson? Check that out. Lots of great matches coming up, and you're going to see a lot of amazing people on board. This is not like a wrestling convention, all right? Wrestling convention, you pay for your ticket, and then you got to go pay for an autograph, and you got to go pay for a picture. It's all inclusive on Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager. See, when you book your cabin, you can hang out with Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler. You can go hang out with Mick Foley, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, Rey Mysterio, Raven, the Keepin' It 100 crew. Beyond the Darkness is going to be there. Colt Cabana and Marty DeRose are going to be there doing their unprofessional wrestling show. Super hilarious. Killin' the Town will be there. Pat Patterson, karaoke night. Brad Williams, Craig Gass, Ron Funches, Silent Q from the Impractical Jokers keeping you laughing. Fozzy, Corey Taylor of Slipknot and Stone Sour, Phil Campbell and the Bastard Sons, King, The Stir, The Dave Spivak Project, The Cherry Bombs, Shoot to Thrill, the world's best female AC/DC cover band, Blizzard of Ozzy, the world's best Ozzy cover band. So many great things happening on the Jericho Cruise. I can't even think of any more people. How about Raven? Let's put him on there. Or how about the Sea of Honor tournament, which you know about? We also got Cody Rhodes, the Young Bucks, Kenny Omega, all going to be there. Brian Cage is going to be there. Melissa Santos is going to be there. Kelly Klein, Mandy Leon, Brandi Rhodes. So many people are going to be there. So don't forget to go book your cabin now at ChrisJerichoCruise.com. And coming up on Friday, you have heard him as a talking head for years. He's been interviewed many times. He's been on this show. We've talked about Brian Pillman with Dave Meltzer. We talked about Chris Benoit with Dave Meltzer. So many great, great shows. But for the first time ever, it's Dave Meltzer on Dave Meltzer. What's the history of the most heralded critic in wrestling history? It's kind of like the Rodney Bingham of wrestling. Yeah, exactly. The Gene Shalit of pro wrestling. The Roger Ebert of pro wrestling. Jess, you ever heard of Roger Ebert? Exactly. Well, this is the Dave Meltzer. He is the Roger Ebert of pro wrestling. We're going to talk about his rise into the business, his relationship with Vince McMahon, how he became the most hated man in pro wrestling at a certain point in time, and then now is accepted and is known as kind of the pundit. He's the Simon Cowell of wrestling. If Dave Meltzer gives you a 5-star rating, it means something. We're going to hear all about his star rating style and all the other things that makes Dave Meltzer one of the most premier wrestling experts in the total history of the business. Coming up this Friday, Dave will be here. Until then, stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy! My Midnight Things! Go check out the new record now. Thanks to Lizzie Borden. We'll see you on Friday.